weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Bad Bunny's Super Bowl halftime performance had over 100 million viewers, ranking as the fourth most watched halftime show in history. And you may be wondering why we are speaking about this on Weather Realness this week. Well, it featured many of Bad Bunny's hits, and the sets and designs were focused on Latin culture, which many people from the Latin community resonated with. But this show also had references to Puerto Rico's underlying history with climate issues, extreme weather events, and how it has impacted the archipelago. So the most extreme example of how climate has impacted the island of Puerto Rico was high-end Category 4 Storm Maria on September 20th, 2017.
The first pictures now coming in from Puerto Rico after taking a direct hit. Hurricane Maria slamming into the island, and as you heard, one official saying the island is destroyed.
Just shy of a Category 5, this is the strongest storm to hit Puerto Rico in nearly 90 years.
The storm had 155 mile-per-hour winds, causing gusts estimated between 175 and 190 miles an hour that damaged almost all wooden structures on the island, stripped vegetation, and even annihilated the National Weather Service radar meant to protect the island. This deluge and wind triggered a total collapse of the power grid, resulting in the longest blackout in U.S. history, leaving 3.4 million people without electricity for months, with some places impacted nearly a year. The resulting humanitarian crisis led to a revised official death toll of 2,975 people, largely due to the long-term loss of medical care, clean water, and communications infrastructure. So speaking to us today to link these events is Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Illinois, Dr. Omar Figueroa, whose research focuses on disaster recovery, environmental inequity, and water issues. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So during the performance, Bad Bunny sings El Apagón, which is a song from his 2022 album, Un Verano Sin Ti, and it's about being in a power outage. This is a reference to Puerto Rico's fragile electricity grid, which has worsened, in fact, after Hurricane Maria hit the archipelago in 2017. And today, frequent outages continue to affect homes, businesses, healthcare, and daily life. So Dr. Figueroa, can you tell us more about the significance of Puerto Rico's frequent outages and why Puerto Rico's resonate with this part of the performance?
Yeah. So to talk about that, we got to go back a little bit and mention a little bit of the history of how that LUMA, which is the company that is basically in charge of generation and distribution and billing in Puerto Rico. So after Hurricane Maria, and I should say that also, during 2017, we had also hurricanes, Irma. And so those like back-to-back hurricanes really had an impact on what unfolded in Maria. So after 2017, the government at the time decided that they needed to do something about it, right? And so they decided that the best way, or I guess the approach that they wanted to undertake to repair and quote-unquote like improve the power system was to like privatize the energy grid. And so that had a lot of opposition from grassroots movements and people on the island that argued that privatizing the grid wasn't going to result in a better grid and better services and even cheaper cost, right? But at the time, Governor Ricardo Rosselló decided that that was the way to go. And so his government was led by neoliberalism policy, so that was kind of like in line with her political views. And so in 2019, Governor Ricardo Rosselló was ousted. And so this is something critical to mention because Bad Bunny was also involved in part of the protest and bringing awareness in, you know, corruption cases and the death during Hurricane Maria, that it was a direct result of government mismanagement, right?
Hubieron muchas personas que salieron a manifestarse por primera vez, que quizás tenían el miedo, pero ese miedo se acabó. Puerto Rico no se va a dejar. Bienvenido a la generación del yo no me dejo, los quiero Puerto Rico.
And in 2020, however, the government in power signed the contract for LUMA, which is the company that we have right now. So LUMA, from the get-go, that was a very sketchy contract. It wasn't really, like, the bidding wasn't public, and so there was a lot of issues there. But a couple of things that end up having an effect in what has eventually unfolded was that, first of all, when Luma took power of the grid, 3,000 employees from the public energy grid company were sent elsewhere. So that means that knowledge of, like, how the power grid works was, like, lost. So that was one of the issues. The other thing, it was that Luma wasn't going to invest in the new, in repairing the grid, that I should also say that has a previous local governments didn't invest in the power grid. So there was an issue of disinvestment for, like, years and decades on the power grid. And so what Luma was going to do was to manage, I believe it was like $10,000 million that were assigned from the federal government, and use that money to do the repairs to the power grid, right? So they weren't invest from their own pockets to improve the grid. So they were going to use the money assigned from the federal government. And so we knew that coming in, like, those two issues were going to have, they weren't going to result in better conditions for the people of Puerto Rico. And so that was like 2021. And so the contract became an effect, and in that first year it was a disaster, a lot of, like, rolling blackouts. And so that's when the crisis started, like, unfolded, right? And so, you know, a couple of things that happened when the power is out, especially for the elderly, you know, that means that there's no, you know, power for, like, storing, like, medicine. We have a very high population of old folks that need, like, ventilators and storing, like, insulins and things of that nature. So definitely they're one of the people, like, highly impacted by these power outages, and also in the educations and the kids, right? Not having electricity and making difficult to study for them, doing homework, right? And so those are, you know, two things that have an impact in terms of the water grid. Not to say that also they have hiked the prices. And so that's also in another layer that we all knew the new company didn't translate in better conditions or cheaper. And by all means has been, like, worse conditions and even, like, more outages and a worse system. Right. And so I think all of those things, Bad Bunny brings it, and he has a couple of songs. I was doing my whole homework last night. And so there's two other songs that he mentions issues about power outages. And I think, how does it feel to not being able to rely on electricity when you're in Puerto Rico? Right. And so we need electricity to do almost everything. So I remember him telling in an interview that when he gives a concert in Puerto Rico, it's like the only, I guess not the only, but one of the few places that he has to think about bringing generators in case electricity goes out, because it will, right? So yeah, that's a little bit of the background and things that happen. And I think that, you know, Bad Bunny is able to bring those things into their song, into their music. And he very explicitly brought it to the Super Bowl with the energy transformers and, you know, people dancing around. And I was surprised to see that, because, you know, people that may not be aware of what's happening in Puerto Rico, they're like, but why they have some, you know, energy poles there? And so I think, like, very subtly but very clear, you know, he brings that awareness. And I think then people start asking the questions of, like, why and how he did those things.
Yeah, it was quite ironic to me to see, you know, basically the pinnacle of American capitalism with this message that we don't even take care of our own people. That was very ironic and was, you know, impacted me.
Yeah, I think that also, maybe this is more implicitly, I think it also brings this idea of, like, resiliency of people in Puerto Rico, right? And so I think one of the movements that we have seen in recent years and coming out of the Just Transition framework and people trying to generate their own energy, because we know that in the island, you know, not only that fossil fuel is not going to carry us forward, but that we're in a crisis and, you know, we need to be able to address that crisis is communities coming together, organizing and creating their own like mini grids. And so we have a very important and I guess now kind of like famous case about microgrids in the heart of the mountainous chain of mountains, La Cordillera Central, in Adjuntas, so Casa Pueblo. If those are of you that are interested, and a grassroots organization that started pushing back against the mining of their hometown. And so they have come up with different projects. And so one of the big and most recent projects out there is creating these like microgrids within the communities. And I don't mean to say like connecting just one, two houses, but also, you know, the bakery, the, you know, the pizza place, and making sure that the people in the community have power to go on their day, and they don't have to rely on that infrastructure that, you know, by all means, it's have been, you know, gutted and bleed out.
So within Puerto Rico, obviously, if you visit, you see there's a lot of differences in sort of socioeconomic statuses, just like here. Were there different communities impacted differently in Puerto Rico? And how does that sort of intersect with the geography of the island?
Yeah, I think that brings an issue of like justice, right? And who gets to bear the brunt of the impacts of a hurricane more deeply. So definitely the rural parts of the islands were deeply hit, and they also have the highest percentages of poverty rates on the island. So definitely rural areas were hardest hit. And because of like how the storm unfolded with the flooding, basically a couple of like towns were incommunicated, but basically not being able to communicate with their neighbors, right? Because it was like flooded. So definitely those rural communities tend to have a higher poverty rate, were definitely impacted. But also in urban areas, we also have like high concentrations of low-income communities. So those communities were just as, you know, just hit as hard, specifically when it came to the infrastructure, right? And this is some of those houses, not all of them are cement and a lot of wood. So they also were severely impacted by those events, right? And so the other thing, when we think about a hurricane, and I think this is something I've been talking to my students and people in general, when we think about disasters, we need to think about like cascading disasters, right? So when the hurricane came to Puerto Rico, it's not only the hurricane, right? It's the flooding, and then it's like the drought conditions post the hurricane, where the tornadoes within the hurricanes. And so all of those things, like you put them together and then you drop them in Puerto Rico that has been battling an economic recession for years, that the power grid was already fragile, that we had high movement migration, changing migration pattern that led to our workforce moving abroad. So we have this less of that. And then you have also the economic recession from 2008. So you have kind of like a perfect storm with everything that unfolded. So I think those social and political conditions is important to understand. So when we think about the complexities of the case of Puerto Rico, like, yes, it was hit by, you know, back-to-back hurricanes, but also the social political conditions on the island. And then the cherry on top, so I leave it for last, was the what is called PROMESA, which is the Oversight Fiscal Control Board. So Puerto Rico as a territory, it cannot file for bankruptcy as any other, you know, city like Detroit was kind of like a very famous case of that. And so basically Congress has to like pass a law for Puerto Rico to be able to file for bankruptcy. And so what that law created, 6 to 7 people that it's in charge of the debt of Puerto Rico, right? And so what that means is that those people have the power of governing in the island. Because the role of the board, it's paying back bondholders, right? It's not improving the economic, the education. And so that board has have a very nefarious consequence on the island. And so when Hurricane Maria hit, we already were experiencing cuts in retirement pensions, on the education system, on healthcare, on even, you know, like EMTs services, right? And so La Junta or Promesa, that was the laws that enacted the board, also play a big role in terms of how the impacts of the hurricanes have played out, and also, you know, why Bad Bunny has been so vocal in bringing those issues to the public eye.
So you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather in Illinois. And we're talking to Dr. Omar Perez-Figueroa, Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. How has Puerto Rico managed to navigate the impact of these hurricanes and extreme weather? And what is the role of the U.S. federal government? Has it been a helpful or hurtful path of adaptation?
My background is that I've been working and supporting grassroots organizations in Puerto Rico for a long time now, I guess more than 10 years. One of the focus of my research has been working or supporting what it's called community aqueducts. And so these are rural systems that basically people came together and to build their own water system, right? And so kind of like the why of what they did it is that because in rural parts of the island, the main water grid doesn't reach them. So basically they took it upon themselves to come together and like organize to being able to not only build the infrastructure to, you know, the pipes and the plumes to take out the water, but also to build an organizations around the issue of like how we're going to give access to water, right? And so I saw how this system have been able to resist some of the impacts of Hurricane Maria, and also, you know, the implications of the sociopolitical system that has kept them with limited resources, right? But I think one of the things that my research highlight is what's the role of like networks. And so I talked about, you know, how these systems were able to start operating next day, right? Because they didn't have to wait for the, you know, like the crews to came and like fix the pipe, because, you know, that's all done in-house. So they have that power of ownership of these, you know, water systems, right? And not to say that these systems are, like, perfect, because, I mean, they're not, and they face many challenges in terms of, like, the quality, being able to continuously operate. But in many cases, they were able to cover and to operate, like, within the next day after Maria. And, in fact, many communities or other communities from the island came to this, you know, resilience hub to be able to get water that some other communities didn't have. And so I guess the role of the federal government, I have mixed feelings about it personally. But that aside, and I think one of the issues when it comes to the federal government, specifically with FEMA, is that the way that FEMA was designed, and after September 11, that FEMA went under Homeland Security. So that had a big change in terms of like how FEMA operate, what are the different red tapes and bureaucratic processes that you have to like navigate in order to apply for funding, right? And even so, and I was looking at the recent data of like how much have been distributed from the federal government in Puerto Rico. So there are still municipalities that haven't received, I think it was even like 25% of what they were already assigned, right? And so there's a clear issue there that the money hasn't been able, or it's not reaching the people, what's intended to help, right? And so, you know, that's there, right? In terms of like how it's low has been, how the issue in Hurricane Maria with the contractors that they granted contracts to people that have no experience. So those things happen, right? But I still think that it is a tool, right, that people in Puerto Rico can still access. However, I'm concerned of what's happening right now with the Trump administration, right, and how they have started making changes. I should say implementing changes that it's already affecting those processes that, you know, they weren't perfect at all by any means, but at least it was, you know, something was reaching to people, right? And so I think it's a complicated relationship between FEMA and the federal government with Puerto Rico when it comes to disaster management, right? And so I think people on the island realize that they cannot wait for them, right? And so, like, no one's coming to save us. And, like, el pueblo salvó el pueblo, right? So, like, people save the people. But some of the changes that the Trump administration has enacted already, that it's already having an implication and not only for Puerto Rico, but for all states being able to get funding, is that one of those issues has to do with the process for applying for funds, right? And so FEMA, before this administration, you would, you know, spend the money and then you would, you know, apply for some of the funding. And so, you know, they would receive your application, they would revise it, and they would tell you, you know, whatever they decided. But what they're doing right now is that they're just, like, sitting on those applications to come in, and then started to, like, process them, right? And so that's created an issue, I think, on one end, because then you're, like, waiting even more time that you were waiting before. And the other thing is that now for communities and government that doesn't have that funding capacity of being able to spend money and then, like, wait to be reimbursed, then I think it's going to be even more hard to try to apply for to get those fund backs.
In general, sort of, how do you think Puerto Rico and the government especially is thinking about climate risk?
That's a complicated question, but it's very good. I think there's the response will depend on which sector you ask, right? And I think the scientific community in Puerto Rico has been organizing for decades, trying to pass legislation, and we even try to pass some legislation to have, like, an actual climate change plan. You know, that faced some, you know, backlash and oppositions in terms of the language that was being used. But, you know, people and researchers just myself, you know, we keep pushing that research out there to keep showing impacts and, you know, to keep showing what are the things that we can do to address some of those impacts. I think grassroots are very aligned with, in some instances, with the scientific community in terms of what things can be done. And I think now in the island has proliferated, like, many companies that are providing solar panels. Like, I think people already figured out that the capacity, but also willingness of the government to improve conditions, it's very limited, at to say the least, right? And so I think now people are getting it, right? And so when I go back home, people are talking about, you know, like, how much it's going to cost me to put solar panels. There's also a boom in organizations that are fighting for an energy transition and, you know, bringing awareness of those issues and what is at stake of continuing, you know, status quo, and why is it that, you know, it's not longer sustainable in the long run, right? And I think going back to Casa Pueblo, they have been very successful at, you know, making that call and rallying up forces to keep, you know, growing the grid and to bring more people. And I think the government, the local government, has missed the opportunity to jump in these issues as supporting what already grassroots organization and the scientific community are doing, right?
Yeah, so as of November of 2025, we looked up and saw that Puerto Rico has reached 1.3 gigawatts of residential solar and over 185,000 residential batteries. And currently there's over 100,000 installations ongoing right now. In terms of energy independence and local control, it seems like that's making progress. But what other solutions or policy changes do you believe can be done to help more energy resilience?
I think what people are doing are strategies in the right direction, right? But also, and I say this in my classes, right? Like, what we can do at the personal level, I think it's important, and it really helps, right? But we need a comprehensive revolution of the policies that are intended to govern energy access and energy production on the island. And, you know, some of the conversations have been from those that have like micro grids. Could they sell back some of that energy, right, and generate revenue, right? What does it lead us? And creating policies that those type of approaches can be supported, right? And so as a way of also fostering like economic benefits for the communities. But I think also we need policies to preserve our land. I think there's this current debate on the island that, you know, many contracts have been given to big hotel chains to build on protected areas, right? And so one of the famous cases right now is Costa Serena. It's not the only one, but one of the ones that had caught, I guess, media attention. And so that worries me, right? Because, I mean, the local government has been very efficient at getting down environmental regulations. And so we don't have regulations in place right now to prevent those type of developments that continue to deepen the environmental crisis on the island. So, you know, moving forward, we need a strong regulation framework that I just said we had. So I think bringing back those regulations would help then, you know, pave the way forward of a just energy transition, right? Because we need to transition out from the fossil fuel, but we need to do it in an equitable manner, right? If the same people are owning the same big projects and, you know, the benefits are not trickling down to the people that need it the most, then we're not really doing anything.
Omar, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Omar Perez-Figueroa, Assistant Professor of Urban Regional Planning at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate in Illinois. I'm Steve Nesbitt. Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.
Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.